Welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Recently, Coca-Cola, the world's largest producer of sugary beverages, has been receiving a lot of media attention because they reportedly teamed up with scientists to fund a new nonprofit. That nonprofit is called the Global Energy Balance Network. Interesting title. The idea was to promote the company's message that the solution to America's obesity problem that we've heard so much about is all about getting more exercise and just stop worrying about cutting all those calories, especially those associated with sugary beverages. The media then, of course, began saying that this was junk science and that they were misleading the public. And that kind of media scrutiny came at a time when the industry is actually showing some decline in soda consumption. And there are also efforts to raise taxes on sugary drinks to get them out of schools, and even efforts to stop the companies from reportedly targeting communities of color. And here closer to home, Berkeley became the first city in the country, you might remember, to pass a tax on sodas and sugary drinks. So we thought this would be a good time to discuss what's happening in the world of soda politics. So joining us today is Marion Nessel. She's the author of the new book, Soda Politics: Taking on Big Soda and Winning. She says that the research is absolutely overwhelming, and it links soda consumption to obesity, poor health, and type 2 diabetes. She's a nutrition scholar and Paulette Goddard professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, and she's the author of 5 prize-winning books, and she joined us on the line from New York. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start with all of the things out there that are bad for us. Why take on soda?
Oh, they're an easy target. In public health terms, they're low-hanging fruit. They're sugars in water and nothing else. They have no redeeming nutritional value. And they're a really easy thing to cut out of people's diets. And in fact, the first thing you do if you want to advise someone to lose weight is get rid of the sugary drinks. And people tell me, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard this, that that was the only dietary change they made and they lost weight. No surprise. They have a lot of calories.
Well, certainly the timing of your book is interesting, given that Coca-Cola has been getting attention for apparently trying to change the narrative about those links that have been found in some reports between obesity and sugary drinks. Last week, the Associated Press actually turned up some internal emails from the so-called nonprofit Global Energy Balance Network's president, James Hill. And he's a professor of medicine, so he's got the bona fides. Coke's chief health and science officer spoke about the company's role in establishing the nonprofit. But now those the science, which says you're just not moving enough. It's not the sugary drinks. You need to exercise more. How significant was this revelation about this link to this nonprofit?
Well, it didn't come as a surprise to me because I had just written a book in which I covered precisely these issues. I just wish that the Times had published that story while I was still writing the book. It would have made my work a lot easier. But I have to say that I talked to a lot of reporters the week after the Times report came out, and they were shocked. They were absolutely astonished that Coca-Cola would fund this kind of research, that investigators would accept money from Coca-Cola for doing this kind of research, and that the universities would take the money. They were just floored. They couldn't believe that this kind of thing went on. Well, if they read my book, they'll understand that this kind of thing is very typical. And it's been Coca-Cola's policy over the last several years to fund research that produces results that cast doubt on the science linking sodas to bad health outcomes, and in particular that promote exercise as the solution to weight problems rather than drinking less soda.
So are you picking on Coca-Cola because they're the 800-pound gorilla? Are they the ones who are leading the industry in lobbying efforts, successfully getting people to drink more and be less concerned about the health effects?
Well, this is a very highly concentrated industry, and what that means is that there are two players who dominate it, Coke and Pepsi, and Coke is bigger. And it also is a company that focuses exclusively on beverages, whereas Pepsi owns Frito-Lay and has snacks and other kinds of products as well. And it's much more protected from concerns about sugary beverages because it sells other things. So Coca-Cola is out there, and what the Associated Press emails showed was that the head of the science, the head scientist at Coca-Cola, was deeply involved not only in encouraging this kind of research, but also in working with the investigators on the design, conduct, and interpretation and publication of the research, which the investigators did not acknowledge in their conflict of interest statement. So that was kind of messy also. And that resulted, I mean, the fallout from this has been absolutely amazing, and you have to give Coca-Cola credit for behaving in a way that's really quite remarkable. First of all, it said it would go transparent, and it would publish the list of every organization that it funded. And that list is on its website, and it's astonishing. It's really long. And then they published a list of every individual that they fund. The Global Energy Balance Network, the university said it was going to give back the $1 million that it has, that it had gotten, and it did. And yesterday, the Global Energy Balance Network announced that it was going out of business and shutting down because it didn't have any more money.
That's extraordinary.
And the head scientist at Coca-Cola has resigned.
Oh, my. That is a tremendous development from those emails, yes?
Yeah, the fallout has been absolutely amazing. And if you want to have some fun, go online, type in Coca-Cola transparency and have a look at the list. It's incredible.
Are you satisfied that that list is complete?
Well, they say it's not complete. What they did was to get permission from every single one of those organizations. That must have been some job. There's at least 1,000. And to put the amount of money that they were getting from Coca-Cola and their names on the website, but they said that there was about $35,000 worth of Coke contributions where the recipient said they didn't want to be identified.
Well,
and three of them have resigned. Three of them have severed their relationship with Coca-Cola. The Maine Dietetics Association, the Pediatrics Association, and the Family Practice Association have all severed their connection with Coca-Cola now.
Clearly they were embarrassed by the revelation, yes?
I hope so. Mm.
Well, if this approach to science by a large corporation sounds familiar, it's because you liken it to the tobacco industry.
Well, not only the tobacco industry, but as far as I can tell, every producer of food is trying to develop research that will help it with its marketing or will contradict its critics. And last March, I started publishing on my website, foodpolitics.com, a list of funded studies that come across my desk, studies that are funded by one food company or another, and every time I get five of them, I post them. I posted one today, as it turned out, and you know, they're from nut organizations, yogurt, sodas, whatever. Any food product that you can think of that has a company behind it would love to have research that shows that it's the healthiest thing since broccoli.
Well, you've certainly written about the food industry and its political lobbying clout for years, and I'm wondering, in the process of your research on soda and soda politics in particular, what struck you about the way the soda industry operates?
Oh, its comprehensiveness. The extraordinary level of detail that it takes in order to buy silence or to buy loyalty. The number of organizations subsidized by Coca-Cola is absolutely extraordinary, and no organization is too small to receive some amount of money. If you're part of a non-governmental organization or an advocacy organization and you are willing to take money from Coca-Cola and you're not getting it, you ought to fire your development director, because they apparently give money to everybody, and no matter how small. And a lot of it is just astonishingly targeted. They fund minority organizations. That's a really big one. They fund exercise organizations. They fund lots and lots of sports. A tremendous amount is focused on African American and Hispanic organizations, and has been for years. So they're really busy.
Why is that, do you think?
Oh, they buy loyalty. In the case of African American and Hispanic organizations, I have a chapter in the book that I call A Complicated Story, because it really is a complicated story. Starting in the 1950s, major groups of African Americans and Hispanic Americans began petitioning the soda companies to hire them and to market to their community publications, because up until that time they were lily white companies that really didn't associate with the minority communities at all, and the companies eventually broke down and started hiring people of color and began advertising in their publications. But that wasn't until there were just tremendous amount of activity around it. In fact, one of the things I came across that I hadn't known before was that the Reverend Martin Luther King, on the night before he was assassinated, gave a speech in which he exhorted his followers to boycott Coca-Cola because they weren't hiring members of the community. So obviously that changed, but then so did obesity and type 2 diabetes, which are a much greater burden in those communities than in the average community or the average white community. And so that has changed the way in which these kinds of things are scrutinized, and there is now a great deal of critical scrutiny giving to soda companies, marketing, support, community support, and cozy relationships with some minority organizations. Not all, but some.
Well, we went straight to the politics of this because that's the title of your book, Soda Politics. But I'm interested, too, in what are we talking about here? We're talking about water and sugar and color, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about...
And flavors.
How do you explain the global reach of what, in effect, is fizzy sugar water?
Oh, it's brilliant marketing. It's been brilliant marketing from the beginning. Well, first of all, people like the taste of it. I mean, they really like the way it tastes. They have no concept whatsoever of how much sugar there is. And, in fact, I can't get my head around how much sugar there is. I finally had to just memorize it. It's 5/6 of a teaspoon per ounce. So it's almost a teaspoon of sugar per ounce of sugars of one kind or another. It's mostly high fructose corn syrup. But it's sugars of one kind or another. And if you have a 12-ounce soda, you've got 10 teaspoons of sugars.
Yikes.
If you have a 20-ounce soda, you have even more. And if you have a 50-ounce soda, you've got even more. I mean, it's just astonishing amounts. And you don't taste it, and it doesn't taste cloyingly sweet, because the flavor, acidity, and bubbles come together to make a really, really attractive taste that people like.
And that's not by accident, I would imagine. I imagine there's a lot of research that goes into how to tweak people's taste buds. And is it an addiction almost, do you think?
Well, some people think it is. And there certainly are people who believe that they are addicted to sodas, meaning that they suffer the same kinds of symptoms that people who are addicted to heroin or cocaine or alcohol might suffer. There's a big debate about whether foods do the same kind of thing that alcohol or recreational drugs do. So I'm uncomfortable talking about it as an addiction, but there certainly are plenty of people who feel that it is.
Well, I have a hunch there's no one listening who has never had one of these. And so everybody has probably had an opinion about whether this is good or bad or whether they should stop or not. So let's invite anyone who's ever had a sugary beverage to give us a call. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can drop us an email too, feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. So again, 866-798-8255. Give us a call. Are you a soda drinker? What do you think about the link between sugary drinks and poor health? Should municipalities be involved in trying to limit your access to these sugary drinks? Or should the government, your local municipality, butt out? And increasingly, Marion, the city of New York tried to limit the size of sodas. The city of Richmond, California, attempted to levy a tax per ounce on soda. Neither one of those were successful. Why do you think that is?
Fabulous public relations by the soda industry. The soda industry, mainly acting through its trade association, the American Beverage Association, recruited front groups. That is, ostensibly grassroots groups, but paid for by the American Beverage Association to go out and collect petitions and tell everybody this was a nanny state effort of government to decide what you're eating, and also pointed out, I think quite properly, that this was a regressive tax that was going to burden the poor more than it burdened the rich. But of course, obesity and its consequences burden the poor more than they burden the rich. In contrast, the soda tax in Berkeley passed. And it passed, I think, because Berkeley framed the debate as Berkeley versus Big Soda. And it did really door-to-door community organizing in every single neighborhood and really rallied the troops so that everybody in the community bought into it. And it won by a plurality of 76%. So I think community organizing is a very important part of it. It wasn't done in Richmond, and it wasn't done in New York City over the soda cap. And I thought if it had been, and if there had been a real effort to bring in the people who were going to be affected by these measures, that they might have had a much better chance of succeeding.
Well, certainly the companies have spent millions of dollars. The American Beverage Association has spent reportedly about $19 million to fight state soda taxes. And in some cases, it seems to have helped. So the question becomes then, if you are discouraging the use of high fructose corn syrup and other sugar names, what do you use instead? And we have a caller who's interested in finding out if it's better to try to use a substitute. That's Lewis from Palo Alto. Hi, thanks for joining us.
I don't know. Is that me? Because I did not speak this. I'm Marie Louise.
Hi, Marie.
So my name is Marie Louise, and I do want to mention a little bit about sugar substitutes, because I have always thought that those things were poisonous, that are also in soft drinks. But other than that, I want to mention how many places on this earth there are people who barely have water to drink, and they have had it pushed on them that they should drink Coca-Cola or other soft drinks, and actually really, really harm them a lot. But if I can add to that, I think our environment, where I live, I sometimes see trucks that are, if they're not as big as a train car, it's awfully close. So just think of all of that. They're on 580, 680, any freeway. We have these huge trucks.
And they're probably bringing Coca-Cola. Okay, thank you, Marie-Louise. And I'm sorry I got your name wrong, but if you wouldn't mind, Marion, would you talk about the sugar substitutes and the extent to which these beverages are being marketed in other countries?
Sure. The sugar substitute issue is a complicated one. I don't personally like the taste of them, so they're kind of off my radar because I have a rule about never eat anything artificial, and these are artificial. I much prefer sugar, in moderation, of course. The research on artificially sweetened sodas shows that on a population level, they have very little effect on body weight. In fact, if you were going to plot the increase in consumption of artificially sweetened sodas, it would go up exactly in parallel with the rise in prevalence of obesity between 1980 and 2000. Now, I would not say that they cause obesity, but they certainly are not associated with any kind of control over it. In individual cases and in individual studies in which people switch from sugar-sweetened beverages to artificially sweetened beverages, some of those studies show that people are able to maintain their weight better, but not all. So it's I think not a simple answer. I don't like the whole business of those chemicals, but for some people they may be very helpful. But on the international side, I think Mexico is the best example of exactly what Marie-Louise was talking about, because Mexico has a very bad water supply in most areas or many areas of the country. And in those areas, the soda companies deliberately went in and attempted to get people to drink sodas instead of water because it was healthier. It came in a bottle. It was clean. They went into churches and suggested that Coca-Cola be used as a substitute for the water that was used in rituals in the Catholic Church. Coca-Cola is deeply embedded in Mexican rural culture, and that's why people were so interested in the soda tax that passed last year, because apparently soda sales are down for the first time, and the revenues for the soda tax are supposed to go into shoring up the water supply so they'll have more clean water available, especially in schools.
So how has that changed the company's business model at all?
Well, it has. Coca-Cola has pledged to put more than $8 billion into marketing in Mexico between now and 2020. And when the tax was first imposed, the soda companies reduced prices of the drinks in rural areas. But that's apparently not happening so much anymore.
I've also noticed these little mini cans, mini bottles, mini smaller packaging. What's that about?
Well, that's about making money while doing good. I'm all for smaller portions. Nobody is worried about an occasional soda in an 8-ounce can, especially if you just drink one and don't drink them too often. And the soda companies charge more for them. So they're much, much more expensive per ounce than the larger size portions. As one retailer once told me, if you want smaller portions, you ought to be willing to pay for them. And I guess people are. And Coca-Cola increased its marketing last year from $200 million just for classic Coca-Cola in the United States to $270 million. And that increase was mostly focused on the small cans because that's where the profits are, and they're doing very, very well with them.
Well, speaking of marketing, this time of the year, you hear that we'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, and there are those cute polar bears drinking Coca-Cola. And, you know, these products, especially Coca-Cola, I would say, are associated with good times and Christmas and Santa Claus. How do you counter that?
Oh, I think with great difficulty. I went to Coca-Cola World in Atlanta a few weeks ago with a couple of reporters, and I was kind of astounded at what an emotional experience it was. You start out your tour through this place by watching a video of extraordinarily touching moments in people's lives, and I can assure you there was not a dry eye in the house afterwards. And then you're let loose to look at the history of Coca-Cola marketing, something about the secret formula. You get to watch commercials for half an hour, and you get to taste products from all over the world, and you exit from through one of the largest gift shops I've ever seen, and along the way you have your photograph taken, and you buy the photographs. It was amazing. I spent a fortune. So the and you're, you know, you're softened up emotionally by the time you get into it, because the marketing is so deeply aimed at how you feel, not your thought processes. So this is not only marketing below the radar of critical thinking, all of that kind of thing is just totally turned off. And I found myself looking longingly at a set of bed sheets with Coca-Cola bottles all over them. It was all I could do to keep from buying them.
It's amazing, huh?
Yeah, I mean, they're brilliant.
Well, we're talking to Marion Nessel. She's a nutrition scholar at New York University and the author of a new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We hope you'll join us. We'll be right back.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. To join in the on-air conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you would prefer to write rather than telephone, the email address for your question or comment is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, and following that at noon today, Philosophy Talk here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco.
Welcome back. We've been talking today with Marion Nessel, and she's really demystifying everything you thought you knew about those delightful, delicious, sugary drinks that you enjoy so much. She is a nutrition scholar of public health at NYU and the author of the book Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. For those of you who are just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And this is Your Call. We're podcasting the show, by the way. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can listen to past shows there, and you can find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we're going to discuss the rise in Islamophobia and what can be done to fight it. We're going to have a roundtable discussion with young Muslims about how they self-identify and how they negotiate their identity in the current environment, particularly after the Paris attacks. And then on Thursday, a conversation about how the 2016 Super Bowl will affect the Bay Area and Santa Clara and San Jose and Oakland, San Francisco. They're all striving to get their part of the Super Bowl commerce and wondering how the big game will transform our region. What effect will it have on the residents? Are you planning to rent out a room on Airbnb while the Super Bowl's going on to try to get a little bit of the commerce? And by the way, if you have a show idea for us, please drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. Today, again, we're talking soda politics, and it turns out there's a lot of politics in soda. We're talking with prominent nutrition scholar Marion Nessel about her new book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Now, Marion, I'm always amazed at the extent to which philanthropy is used as part of the marketing strategy for these companies.
Well, it's, again, astonishing, and Coca-Cola, in revealing the list of the 1,000 organizations that it funds, gave a sort of opened a window on all of that. The philanthropic donations are to anti-hunger organizations, to minority organizations, to organizations devoted to children's health, to children's activity, to sports, to all kinds of things that must be just wonderful for the organizations that are receiving these donations and receiving these grants. sometimes they cause trouble. And that was what happened when it was revealed that the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics and the Associations for Pediatrics and Family Medicine, all three organizations have had substantial sections of their membership who were very, very concerned about the Coca-Cola partnership and didn't think the organization should be doing that. And those organizations have now split from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola says it did the splitting, and the organizations say that they did the splitting. I don't know which is which, but whatever it is, Coca-Cola is no longer funding those organizations.
Interesting. And we want to invite people, if you drink soda, do you let your children drink soda? What has been your experience in terms of enjoying sugary drinks and maybe deciding to give them up? Please give us a call, 866-798-TALK, or you can post a web comment at your radio, yourcallradio.org. You know, it was very fortunate we were able to get an independent individual, Marion, to talk with us about his ideas about the idea of taxing sugary drinks in order to get people to curtail their use of them. And if it's okay, I'm just going to bring him in now for a bit of the conversation. It's Balin Linekin, and he's the founder and executive director of Keep Food Legal. It's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit, and they advocate in favor of food freedom, as they call it, the right of every American to grow and raise and produce and cook and eat and drink whatever they like. And I'm grateful that you were available to talk to us today, Balin Linekin. Are you there?
I am. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yes, indeed. Big beverage companies are fighting back, and their response specifically to Marion Nestle's book is, quote, the people who make up America's beverage companies have a long history of engaging in thoughtful discussions and meaningful actions to address the public health issues of overweight and obesity. And they're pushing back hard against the science that says that these beverages should be curtailed. And your position is what? That Americans, that it's un-American, basically, to try to get people to curtail the consumption of these drinks?
I wouldn't say that. My position is that Americans have and should have a right to make their own food choices, and that doesn't really matter what the food choice is. It could be soda, it could be raw milk, it could be foie gras, it could be choosing to share food with the homeless and less fortunate, which are all issues that I've you know, stuck up for producers and consumers in those areas. It doesn't particularly matter what the food is, in the same way that when the ACLU is defending free speech, they're defending free speech. They're not saying, you know, this particular speech is great and that particular speech isn't, and so therefore we'll defend this one and not that one. They're pretty much agnostic to the food or the speech in that case, as I am with the food.
Marion, your thoughts?
Well, I think people have a right to make their own food choices, but people don't make food choices in a vacuum. And in the case of soda marketing, they're making choices in the face of billions of dollars poured into advertising, marketing, social responsibility, funding of organizations, and all the behind-the-scenes stuff that soda companies do to make sure that the market for their products is protected. So it's not a level playing field.
Well, let's bring in a caller, and this is Michelle from Pacifica, and your question is for Marion. Michelle, go ahead.
Yes, I just found what Marion said earlier about the history of large investments of private industry, not government industries, but private industries, such as Coke and Pepsi, in areas that are really diverse. And I was just wondering if Marion could share any ideas or examples of how we can continue to get information and build a community of informed consumers, and how do we include that in our Silicon Valley area, where diversity should be considered if you have a disproportionate number of people who are showing signs of diversity in terms of weight and obesity. What is the responsibility of these companies putting together a diverse strategy, including their vendors and those who, you know, offer money and investments to them? How can we build a strategy to be very conscious and of who we're doing business with?
Marion?
I'm not sure I understand the question, and I'm not sure whether the caller is talking about weight diversity or racial and ethnic diversity or all of the above.
All of the above, because
all
they're connected.
All of the above.
Yes.
Because they're connected. Well, I think we need sensitivity to this all the way around. And the soda companies have dealt with it by funding organizations. The organizations ask for the money so that this is a cooperative agreement. And I think if people want changes, they have to organize and work together to get the kind of changes that they want and ask for them very specifically.
Okay, thank you for that call. Baylin Linnigan, I was wondering, because it turns out that some of the big beverage companies have actually made a pledge to help reduce the per capita consumption of sugary beverages by something like a fifth, 20% by the year 2025. Does this imply, I mean, that the companies feel that they have some public health responsibility, or should they even feel compelled to do such a thing?
Well, I'm not here to speak on their behalf, but soda consumption's been falling for more than a decade, so they would essentially just be continuing a trend that already exists. And it's worth noting, of course, that obesity has risen even as soda consumption has fallen. So you would think that if there was some obvious connection between the two, that as consumption fell, obesity would fall. And again, we haven't seen that. But as far as whether soda companies are marketing fewer calories, I think they're responding to consumer demand. I think all smart businesses do that. And I think that you've seen, other sort of non-beverage producers, whether it's fast food makers and others, respond with smaller sizes and smaller portions and fewer calories. And that's something that, consumers increasingly care about. So it's smart of them to respond to that demand.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to Donna in Oakland. Donna, you've had a soda experience. Tell us about it.
I did have a soda experience. I'm actually a public health researcher. I look at research integrity, but that's not why I'm calling. I'm calling because when I was at school, Mary and I went to the same school as you did, I think, Berkeley School of Public Health. And we were in class one day, and this water was out to the building we were in. And it was one of those very unusual hot days in Berkeley. I think it was 100 degrees. And I went to this soda machine, and all the water was gone. I had not had a sugary beverage probably in over 20 years because I don't like them. And I saw the water was gone, and I decided, well, I have to drink something. And I don't really like the idea of chemicals either, so I didn't want a diet soda. So I got some soda, some clear thing. I figured a clear thing might be better than a brown thing. And I drank half of the bottle. It was a 20-ounce bottle, and I chugged it down. I was very thirsty. And it hit me like cocaine almost. Don't ask me how I know about that. but it was astounding. I was so jacked up by this stuff, and then immediately felt terrible, almost, 2-3 minutes later. So, and I only drank half the bottle. So that's just my comment.
So, Marion, you're a nutrition scholar. What do you think about that? Not surprised, I would imagine.
Well, sugar gives you energy, and it gives you energy in a hurry when it comes in liquid form. I mean, that's another issue about sodas that people are concerned about. Is there some evidence? I don't want to push it too hard because I think it's preliminary, but there's some evidence that sugars in liquid form are worse for you than eating sugar through food because it's absorbed more quickly and it messes up the hormonal balance faster. So it's not such a good idea. You don't drink your calories. That's one of the pieces of advice. But I think for people who aren't used to drinking really heavily sugared drinks, you get a sugar high. Why not?
Well, as the public awareness about sugar has spread and caught on, we're certainly seeing a lot of people who think that they're making a good substitution, maybe, by drinking the drink like teas and energy drinks. Your thoughts on that? The ones that don't have the fizz, the people tend to think, I think, that they're better for you.
Well, they have to read the label. If they have the same amount of sugar than a regular carbonated soda does, then the substitution isn't doing them very much good. And I'm always surprised at how much sugar there is in sweetened teas. And people are using sports drinks that are also quite sugary and also have a lot of caffeine in them. Things like Gatorade have half the sugar, but they're still sugary drinks. I just think that drinking sugar isn't such a great idea. I like sugar, I have to say. I just try to keep it moderate and keep it solid.
So you're not an absolutist. Actually, speaking of label reading, Ruby in Greenbrae is on the line, and you want to know, how do you get people to read those nutrition labels? Ruby, is that right? Ruby, are you there?
We've lost Ruby.
Okay, no problem. Well, you know, okay, actually, Ruby, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hold on a second. I'm going to take you off my earphone. Hang on. I don't want to miss this opportunity to talk to Dr. Nessel, my hero, my heroine.
Go right ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
Excellent. So I've done a lot of research on reading labels, and Dr. Nessel's point just a moment ago was about other sugary drinks. So I go into people's refrigerators whenever I'm visiting a home, and I take out a Snapple, and I say, do you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's also 2.5 servings. So beyond the shock that they're drinking 27 teaspoons of sugar in this Snapple, peach flavor, I think, is the worst. I want to ask Dr. Nessel if she is aware or happens to actually know when they're going to list a daily recommended amount of sugar on the nutrition label, which would be so helpful if we can ever get people to read it, including my husband, and we've done a film on it, and he doesn't read any labels. What can I do?
Labels are hard. The FDA, the last I heard was a rumor that the FDA would produce its new label rules in March of 2016, that they would have them ready by then, but I have no idea whether that's true or not.
Okay, and Baylin Lineken, keep food legal. What about full disclosure in labeling? I think there was an issue recently with Cheerios. They were talking about the extent to which it was good for you, the new Cheerios, but it turns out that there was actually 17% more sugar. So, and, of course, we know that sugar can hide in so many different names. So what are your thoughts about full disclosure on labeling?
Every single FDA-mandated label today contains the amount of total sugar in a serving on it right now, and I think that that's a great idea, and I think that that, you know, should continue. I think there's an effort by the FDA to have added sugars be included, and I think that can be misleading because you then is added sugar part of total sugar? You tend to confuse consumers, and I think that sort of having basic essential information is far more important than gumming up the entire food label with a variety of information. You know, you have other people who want other things on labels, and pretty soon you have this thing slapped with a bunch of different graffiti, and it doesn't serve the consumer interest. We've seen this with menu labeling in restaurants, for example, that's mandated. Most studies, one was referred to in the New York Times yesterday, have shown that mandatory menu labeling doesn't help consumers make better choices.
Okay. Let's go to Cynthia in Berkeley, and you wanted to weigh in on why you think taxes on sodas, excess taxes, are classist.
Yeah, they're classist and they're paternalistic, and I can go to, you know, Chez Panisse, or I can go to an expensive bakery, and I can eat lots of sugar that is very unhealthy for me, because I can afford it, and I don't have to pay a tax on that. And this is because wealthy people like to tell poor people what is good for them. And so if poor people want to get their sugar in soda, which they can afford, I need to tell them that that's bad for them, and I need to price them out of the market. And I just find the whole thing quite distasteful. So you have your gentleman on there who's talking about how this is, you know, this is, it's everyone's right to eat whatever food they choose. And I just want to point out that the people whose, you know, rights we want to affect are the people who don't have the income to, you know, get a double latte at Starbucks or go to Chez Panisse and order two desserts.
Baylen Linnikin, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with the caller 100%. Mm-hmm. I do think that it is classist and paternalistic. I know that during the first half hour of the show, you know, Marion noted that you know, that soda taxes do act as a burden on low-income consumers, and she countered, as she does in her book, that is, you know, also the case that things like diabetes and obesity also impact low-income and poor Americans, and that's true as well. But I'm not sure how doing something like taxing and essentially taking money from those poor and low-income Americans makes them any healthier.
And Marion,
I'm wondering if they feel the same way about cigarettes and cigarette taxes.
I mean, I'm a food lawyer, so I don't really have much of an opinion on tobacco. But I know that you know, food is something that people need to live, and tobacco is not.
Sodas. People don't need sodas to live.
No, they don't need milk or ham or chicken or grain-based desserts, which actually the latter two are greater sources of calories in the American diet than is soda, those bread-based desserts and chicken. But, you know, we're not taxing chicken, and we're not pushing people away from grain-based desserts with punitive taxes.
Well, they have nutrients in them as well, and they're much more complicated, which is why I keep saying sodas are low-hanging fruit. I think the class issues are really important, and I worry about them a lot. And one of the factors that was really critical to Berkeley's passing the soda tax was that the community rallied around that tax, and that meant the low-income community as well as the high-income community. They were able to see that it would be healthier and better for everybody if people were drinking less soda.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quick caller. Denise in San Francisco, about a minute. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like you to talk about how much water it takes to make Coke and other sweet drinks, and talk about how these businesses are siphoning water sources all over the world, and especially in India, where they are taking water needed for agriculture.
Marion?
Yeah, I have a chapter in my book on exactly that issue. And what's I laughed when I heard the question, because it depends on who does the calculation. When the soda companies do the calculation, the amount of water needed to make soda is extremely low. And Coca-Cola, for example, is very proud that it's gotten its water footprint down to 1.2, meaning 1.2 liters of water for every liter produced. But if independent investigators do the calculating, they count other things, like how much water it takes to grow the sugar and how much water it takes to clean the bottles and the plant and what you have to do to dilute the wastewater so it doesn't poison the local water supplies and the land around it. And those numbers are much, much higher, in the hundreds of liters.
Well, I think, and thanks for the callers, I want to give both you, Marion, and Baylen Linnikin an opportunity to just make your final arguments. I think the kind of exchange that you had is classic. It's exactly what's going on in the scientific and the marketing communities about this issue. So, Marion, if you would, just give me your final thoughts.
Well, I'd just like to say that my book was really about advocacy for sodas. The soda industry thinks that public health advocates are responsible for the decline in sales. I'm not going to argue with them. But the book is largely about how you go about doing that if you want to do advocacy for a healthier food system.
All right. And Baylin Linnigan, the executive director of Keep Food Legal, your thoughts?
I mean, I think advocacy in the non-governmental sector is important. I think that the marketplace of ideas is strong enough that opinions like Marianne's that one should drink less soda, and opinions of others that consumers can make up their minds. I think that the most important thing, because I'm interested mainly in law and policy issues here, the most important thing to remember is that the federal government subsidizes corn, which gets turned into high fructose corn syrup, a sweetener that's commonly used in beverages like sodas, and also supports the sugar industry. So the federal government is essentially signaling to farmers to grow more sugar, to produce more high fructose corn syrup. And that's a problem in Congress, and Congress needs to fix that. They need to end farm subsidies, and these policies that are propping up the local level that we see with suggestions for things like soda taxes really end up hurting consumers twice. Once, they have to pay for these farm bill policies that prop up producers, and then a second time, they are punished essentially for buying the foods that the government has encouraged them to buy.
Well, I want to thank both my guests, Marion Nessel, author of Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning, and Baylin Linnigan. He is the executive director of Keep Food Legal. I'll bet you'll never take another sip of soda without thinking about at least one of the arguments you heard here today. I want to thank you for joining us, and thanks for your emails and phone calls. Thanks to Laura Flynn for helping me today. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, the rise in Islamophobia. Since the Paris attacks, the Not In My Name campaign has resurfaced. It's an attempt to distance Muslim identity from actions of groups like ISIS. Meantime, daily reports of Islamophobic acts, from Middle Eastern-looking people being removed from flights to attacks on mosques. What can be done to fight Islamophobia? On the next Your Call with Hanna Baba and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.